This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Each year, 25,000 Americans receive life-saving organs in transplant surgeries. But at any moment in time, three times that number, 75,000 people, are waiting for an organ. And each year, 5,000 people die while they wait. In this portion of the program, we take a look at organ transplantation and the ethical issues that surround organ transplantation. Our guest is medical ethicist Ronald Munson. He is professor of philosophy of science and medicine at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He's the author of several books, including Intervention and Reflection, Basic Issues in Medical Ethics. It is the most widely used medical ethics text in the United States. He's also the author of three novels, and like his novels, Munson's latest book is written for a wide audience. Its title, Raising the Dead, Organ Transplants, Ethics, and Society. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Ronald Munson. Join the discussion with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Ronald Munson, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Nice to be with you.
Demand for organs exceeds supply. Why is that the case? Why are so many people on waiting lists?
So many people are on waiting lists because we have no alternatives in many cases to prevent people from dying except for organ transplants. And even if we were perfect at retrieving donor organs, which we are not, we would still have a difficulty in making up the number of organs we need. This is particularly true of kidneys. So there are two aspects to the problem. One is the acquisition of the organs, and the other aspect is how we distribute them when we get them. And these twin problems are what lie under virtually all the ethical and social issues connected with organ transplantation.
What could we do to be better, to reach for perfection in terms of getting organs and distributing them?
Well, I think the first thing is an awareness of the need for organs. I know that everyone in principle in this country has heard that transplant organs are needed, but I think that there are few, statistically, who have taken the additional step to let their family members know that if anything should happen to them and their organs could be retrieved and used to save the life of other people, and in any given case, as many as 5 or 6 people might have their lives saved or extended by the use of transplant organs, that they want to be a contributor to that. Because ultimately, it's the next of kin, it's the family, it's the spouse, it's the brother who makes the decision as to whether organs are taken from the recently dead.
And what are our policies today in terms of distribution? How are organs allocated?
Organs are allocated not by means of a national system of allocation, not by a national waiting list, although the system itself is national, but on a regional basis. And this has always been the source of considerable controversy. But the reasoning behind this is that charity begins at home, that people are more likely to donate their organs if they know they're going to go to a neighbor, to someone in their community, and someone in their state, than if they're going to be, say, shipped off to Pittsburgh when they are living in a small town in Illinois. So it's that principle that is thought to, whether it does or not, is at least thought to lie behind the increasing the likelihood of people's becoming donors.
And also, it's my understanding that folks who are the sickest have a priority.
They have a priority, but they only have a priority locally. It's quite possible in our current system of organ donation, although it's, in the case of livers, it's now under a matter of discussion, so what I say has to be seen in the context of all of these issues being reviewed, but it's quite possible now that an organ may go to someone in a region, and there may be someone sicker in another region. So when you say it goes to someone who is in most in need, that's true, but you have to understand that there are 11 regions in the U.S., and it's really to the sickest in that region.
Mm. You mentioned livers, and you mentioned the regional situation. One of the most famous transplant cases is that of Mickey Mantle, and this is a case you write about in the book. You write about his case and the issues it presents at some length. By 1995, Mickey Mantle's liver was failing. He was suffering from cirrhosis, cancer, hepatitis C. He was a recovering alcoholic. What was his situation there in Texas at Baylor? Why did he receive a liver?
That has been a point of controversy since he received the liver. And I think he's been regarded quite often with hostility that is undeserved. He got the liver he got because he was the sickest person in that region at that time. He was the one, and livers are matched by size and by blood type. He met all the criteria. He was likely to die within 24 hours. The liver that was available was the right blood type, it was the right size, and Baylor had a standby candidate just in case something happened to him. For example, he died before the liver was transplanted into him. But because he was famous, this prompted the view that he got it so fast and the fame must be responsible. But so far as I can determine, that's simply not the case. Although it's worth discussing. Mm-hmm. It's worth discussing because it raises the question, do we want to take into consideration what are usually called social worth criteria when we distribute organs? It's possible to say, well, yes, let's look at who makes the contributions in our society, or in whom have we invested most of our social goods? How about a pediatrician versus a computer programmer? Who does the most good? Who has cost us most? Who do we need most? Should we then, in cases of conflict, say, well, you know, this organ should go to A rather than B? I think not. I think we live in a society in which the success of our society is dependent to a commitment to an equality, that each person is worth just as much as any other person, no matter how well educated, no matter what the contributions have been, that everyone counts the same as everybody else. And that, I think, is the case that Mickey Mantle shows in contrast, because when people thought that he was getting a liver he didn't deserve, they were ready to condemn him, the medical transplant establishment, and indeed the whole transplant operation.
Well, if at that moment when Mickey Mantle is in the hospital waiting for a liver, if there's somebody who's you know, in the exact kind of same position that he was in, other things being equal, is there ever a time to use the social worth factor to factor that in?
Well, I think we have decided as a society, no, we don't want to count social worth, because where would we stop? You know, first, how would we calibrate it? Is a kindergarten teacher worth less or more than a pediatric surgeon? Who is worth more? Someone who is a university professor? Someone who is a maintenance worker? We don't have any ways of saying this is better than that, this person is better than that. So I think that we're happy enough with our system of counting everyone on a first-come, first-served basis. But now, having said that, let me step back for a moment and say the truth is that except in the case of kidneys, the major criterion for receiving an organ transplant is having some means to pay for it.
Mm.
We don't distribute organs to people who don't have the means, either means through insurance, means through Medicare or Medicaid, means through private income, to support the surgery and, just as important, to pay the $10,000 or more dollars a year that it takes for medications and tests to maintain the transplant.
Are insurance policies likely to cover the cost? And if someone is poor and would qualify for Medicaid, how is that situation handled?
Well, if you are very poor, you can qualify for Medicaid, and Medicaid will pay for the transplant. But if you are not very poor, if you have some resources, but you are, for example, underinsured, your insurance company will pay, for example, $10,000 towards a transplant, but a heart transplant would cost you in the neighborhood of, say, $50,000 to $75,000, then you have to find some other way to come up with that money. If not, you don't get the heart transplant.
Hmm. Is there any way around that?
Well, you know, it sounds cynical, but the people who have faced these issues have turned to their families, to their friends. They've had fundraising activities. The truth of the matter is, and this points to, I have to say, and not everyone will agree with me, but I think this points to a great weakness in our medical care system, that we have available a life-saving technology, but we hold that technology and to use only with people who have the ability to pay for it. It's quite possible to have a six-year-old child die from lack of a liver transplant from parents who simply don't have enough money to pay for it. And I don't think many of us, when we think about it, want to live in a society in which that's possible. But healthcare funding is such a politically difficult and complex topic, one that has so much interest in conflict, that I think it will be a long time before we sort out what the issues are and come to a resolution, one that will allow us to provide this kind of life-saving technology to people who need it, not just those who can pay for it and need it.
Mm. You open the book with the case of a man by the name of Robbie Benson. He's a candidate for a heart transplant. Maybe we could go through his case as a way of kind of illustrating some of these issues that we've been talking about to this point. Why did he need a heart transplant, and was he a good candidate?
This is a person who is has heart failure of unknown origin, perhaps a genetic factor, although it's possible, although there's no evidence for it in this particular case, that his heart was damaged by some infection. But he, if he does not get a transplant, has no other option other than death. He's not someone who can be treated medically. Medical management has failed. He is, in the account that I give, he is placed on a left ventricular assist device, or LVAD, a implantable pump that keeps his blood circulating while a donor is found. This has literally been a life-saving device for people who have to wait for heart transplants because they can be supported on that device in the way that people who have kidney failure can be supported by dialysis until a suitable organ comes up. I have to say at this point, by the way, that there is no such device that can take over liver function, which is why the distribution, acquisition and distribution of livers is quite often such a very heated topic for discussion. People who are in liver failure simply have no option. There are no machines that will perform their function. So as a result of that, if they don't get a liver in time, they will die. But in the case of Robbie Benson, there is a machine. It was successful. And eventually, he did receive a transplant. It was a transplant given to him because he met the criteria. He was at a point in which he was unable to live outside the hospital without medical support. He was someone who required constant medical attention. So when a heart became available at another institution that was matched to him for size and for blood type, then the heart was implanted in him. This is not a miracle story, except that his life was saved. It's a secular miracle in a sense. But in a sense, and this is where the news stories usually stop, after the transplant, Robbie Benson's life was not simply restored the way that it used to be. He indeed, as people in the transplant field said, he exchanged one disease for another. He became a transplant recipient, which meant that he had to be monitored constantly. He had to be someone who took his anti-rejection medications. He had to suffer the side effects of those medications, and he would have to undergo periods of rejection in which he would have to have his medications increased or altered or new combinations used to make certain he didn't reject his heart, because if that happened, he would be back in the same position he was before, and he would have to be dependent. He might even be in worse shape. He would have to be dependent on getting a second transplant. So it's important to realize that transplants are genuinely a life-saving technology. They're one of the great triumphs of the 20th century, but they are not what is possible. They are not the ideal solution.
Hmm. How are people like Robbie Benson prepared for life after a transplant?
Most of them are, it's explained to them in group sessions or individual counseling, how it is that they are going to have to change their lives. And one of the ways that they change their lives is that they simply have to be very careful about whether they engage in certain kinds of activities, whether they run the risk of infections, whether they can take the chance of traveling in places where they may not have adequate medical help. But most transplant patients are simply told, go out and live your life. You know, don't worry too much about it. Because the concern is that when someone has had a kind of medical experience of this magnitude, it's important for them to gain confidence and not let the experience make them so timid about life that they fundamentally turn themselves into kinds of transplant cripples, when, as a matter of fact, they could live a good life. The life is restricted in some ways, and as I say, they in some sense acquire a chronic illness that must be treated all the time, but nonetheless, there is a life for them to live, and all are encouraged to live it.
Ronald Munson is our guest this afternoon. He's a medical ethicist. He's professor of philosophy of science and medicine at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He's the author of Raising the Dead, Organ Transplants, Ethics, and Society. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on Line 1 in Champaign. Hi.
Hello. Thank you. I'm curious, have you read the book A Change of Heart by Claire Sylvia, and what you would have to say about the ethics of contact between recipients and donor families?
Well, first, I have to admit that I have not read the book, but I'd be perfectly happy for you to give me a summary of it, but I think I know what it's about. But in answer to your last question, I think that we have, by and large, worked out a system which is quite effective, in which we have, with some exceptions, kept donor families isolated from recipients. Now, in part, I think that the reason for doing that is that this, on both sides, these are very emotional experiences. And you have to keep in mind that it's not just usually one donor family and one recipient family. It may well be that there is a donor family and there are as many as 4 to 6 recipient families for organs. So right there, I think that it's a difficulty of kind of social relationships. And keep in mind, too, that there's not just that one organ goes to a particular person, as in the Mickey Mantle case, as I mentioned. There is someone else who is standing by in case the candidate dies, in case some unexpected complication occurs, something new which was not recognized before, some new factor emerges, so that the donor who is intended is not necessarily the donor that ends up, the recipient that's intended is not necessarily the recipient who ends up with a donor organ.
Well, of course, I mean, that's an issue of, to some extent, of whether or not the contact is before or after. Once the person has received the donation, then they are the person who has it, and it's not really.
I agree. I mean, I don't think that necessarily there should be hard and fast rules. I know that there are the recipients, by and large, are immensely grateful to donors. Sometimes, though, they're so grateful to donors that they're overwhelmed by it and have, in some ways, don't wish to meet the families because they feel, the donor families, because they feel then that they will be under such a burden that it will be a crippling experience for them.
Well, she certainly makes a compelling case in her book for the benefits of that contact when both sides are, you know, are open to it. I don't think she would, you know, say you should force people to get together.
Right,
but,
right.
Certainly in her case, it helped answer a lot of questions about the experience she had, because she had a lot of recovered memories from the male recipient who. It is quite fascinating, the kinds of changes and things that of her own behavior and how that then correlated with things going on in his life, and then things that were left unresolved between the donor and his parents. And
well, I understand the point that you're making about the relationship between donors and families. And I agree that if there is some mutual willingness to meet, then I don't think that we should put barriers in the way. But as I said, I think that this has to be mutual. As to the point that you make, and as the point is in the book, I haven't read the book, but I did read reviews of the book and alluding to just what you were talking about, I don't think we have any information that was reliable that any organ that was transplanted carries with it any memories of the donor. Now, I understand that that's the thesis of this book and that this person is reporting her experiences. But keep in mind that there may be alternative explanations for the experiences that she reports.
Well, I suppose there could be. She makes a pretty compelling case, and she's not the only person. Bernie Siegel, by the way, Dr. Bernie Siegel wrote the foreword for the book. And I would highly, it's a quick read, I'd highly recommend that you should give it a look.
I will certainly take your recommendation, and all I ask for you is to keep in mind that a person's interpretation of her experiences is not necessarily an accurate account of the causes of her experiences, whatever she may believe them to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly understand that, but I think that, you know, it's good for you to keep an open mind as well.
I will.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. It does speak to the power of, you know, as it is alluded to in the title of your book, Raising the Dead, how life-giving, how powerful this experience is.
It is. And in fact, I chose the title of the book because transplant recipients are not just grateful, typically, although they certainly are. They're much more than grateful. They feel as though they have been restored to life. They feel that they have been given their lives back when they were on the verge of death. And I think that the title of my book is intended to capture the strong character of that experience. And, of course, it's that emotionally overwhelming experience that expresses itself in the gratitude towards donors. As I said to your caller, sometimes that gratitude is almost overwhelming, mm-hmm. so much so that recipients, as grateful as they are, don't really trust themselves to deal with the families of the donors.
Yeah. You write a little bit about this in the case of Robbie Benson. His wife Marge, leaving the hospital, tells the nurse who is the transplant coordinator, we're planning to write to the family of the donor. And the nurse, Carol Lee Phillips, says, you know, most people say that they are going to do that, but in the end, very few people carry through. And when you stop to think about it, you know, what do you say?
Well, I think that's what stops them most. Those are the kind of experiences that are literally so overwhelming that people are struck dumb. They just don't know what to say. Words in those cases seem inadequate. They can just say, thank you, but what a difference between saying thank you for receiving a new heart and thank you for receiving a bouquet of roses. It just doesn't. It's not something that they know how to do.
Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yeah, I've got several questions. I was wondering, the people that donate kidneys, that falls off after a certain age, doesn't it, as far as the usefulness of their donation? Isn't that true?
You mean the people who receive a kidney, does the kidney last forever?
No, I meant, if you're 70, is it worth your giving up your kidney?
Well, everybody has to be assessed on individual terms, and age is certainly a factor. You know, as time goes on, various organ systems begin to fail, as everybody who's crossed a certain threshold begins to realize. But it can only be determined in individual cases, really.
Mm.
There are no age limits on recipients, and technically there are no age limits on donors. But again, if you just talk in terms of probability, after the age of 55 or so, the organs are not as likely to be in transplantable condition. And this is an important point too, because recall that any transplant surgery, to say the least, major surgery, and this is heavy-duty surgery, so. Transplant surgeons are very reluctant to give someone an organ that is less than optimal because you're subjecting someone to the surgery and making the condition perhaps even worse by an organ that's less than optimal. So that's why the character of the organ is transplanted has to be a very good one. So your question is right to the point.
Yeah, actually, I have quite a few. I'm going to probably get cut off, but that's okay.
Okay.
are there any mechanical kidneys on the horizon?
Well, there's no mechanical kidneys. If you mean transplantable, like a heart that could be stuck in if it really worked, because the dialysis equipment works so well. I mean, there are surgical techniques for having dialysis take place inside the body. And there are some people who are successful at that, but kidney transplants themselves are so successful that it rather eclipsed this kind of dialysis.
Mm. Another thing is, I understand that though we've had our discussions, and I understand they're also getting trending toward people being in favor of allowing people to sell their kidneys. Even in this country, but worldwide, I understand that in very desperate situations, there's a de facto thing. I was just wondering, what is the reality right now as far as people buying kidneys worldwide?
Well, the reality is that it can be done. It can't be done legally in this country, but it can be done in India, some Middle Eastern countries, in the Philippines. There are various connections established in which people, even from this country, travel to other countries and have a kidney implanted, one that they have paid a donor for. Are we going to permit that? I doubt it very much, but I think it's important to keep in mind that our policy, there's a 1984 law that says you can't sell any organ, transplantable organ, for any consideration. You can't sell it for anything. I feel that's a bit hypocritical. As I mentioned earlier, we have a medical care system in which we, in effect, let people die because they don't have enough money for a liver transplant. But at the same time, we tell other people, you can't sell your kidney. You can't receive any money for it. That being the case, then, we have to ask ourselves, are we being coherent here? Are we making sense about what it is that we're doing? Don't we want to change our system so that we don't force people in positions in which they would have to sell a kidney? In the book, I sketch a case. It's a case that's an imagined case simply because this is an illegal activity in which a woman sells her kidney. in order to get the money that she needs to pay for a bone marrow transplant for one of her children. Because it's quite possible, and indeed it does happen in this case, that someone suffering from leukemia may need a bone marrow transplant, but not be able to afford it. So why is it that we consider it would be so wrong for a mother to sell a kidney to get the money she needs to provide for her child's transplant?
I think I agree with you. The more I think about it, it doesn't seem as if there's that much humanity invested in kidneys. You know?
No. And we also allow kidney exchanges. You know, suppose you have someone, you wanted to donate a kidney to a relative, for example, but your kidney was not a match. But there's someone else who wanted to donate a kidney to her relative, and her kidney wasn't a match for the relative's. But if you exchanged, you would each have to do it. Well, once you get that kind of exchange relationship, what is selling but using some other substitute for the literal exchange?
One last question, and I'll get off and just listen. But I was wondering, I know I was on the Public Citizen website, and they've got a couple-year-old report claiming that a study out of Case Western University found that there were significant racial and gender inequities in organ distribution. And I was wondering if that was something you agreed with or took strong issue with or what.
Well, I think that what you see there is a kind of artifact of our medical care system, as well as various social factors. For example, African Americans are more in need of kidneys than any other particular group because of hypertension, because of the kinds of diseases that is more common among African Americans than, say, among the Caucasian population. And yet they are also in the group of people who are most distrustful of medical care. So quite often they will not seek care when others would. So that's part of the system. Also, there are many people who are in the socioeconomic category who are not able to afford, say, a liver transplant or a heart transplant. So partly what you see in the statistics are not discrimination on the basis of what transplant centers do, but it's an outcome of social structures and social factors.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. Other calls, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, medical ethicist Ronald Munson. In the book, Raising the Dead, there are two chapters about xenotransplantation. Very interesting. And you open the first of these chapters with a horrific scenario, fictional, with xenotransplants leading to an epidemic of a horrible fever, a hemorrhagic fever. If this is possible, should we abandon our research into xenotransplantation?
Well, that's what we should be debating. I think that most people who have gotten their news about xenotransplantation, of using animal organs and transplanting them into humans, have only gotten the tip of the story because it's always some new breakthrough that's going to make this possible. And this has gone on for 10 or 15 years. But the story behind the story, there are several of them, but one of them is we may be taking a risk here that we have not been aware of sufficiently. Pigs in particular, which are the most likely animals for transplant purposes, have intertwined in their DNA viruses that don't affect us directly. We usually don't get pig diseases, but what we don't know about would be what would happen if we were successful in, say, making use of pig kidneys transplanted into people, and those viruses came into contact with human blood and human tissue for, say, a period of 2 years or 5 years. Would there be some genetic recombination? Would there be some mutation in those endogenous retroviruses that are in the pig DNA? If so, it's at least possible, and no one knows how likely it is, but it is at least possible that a new virus could be produced that would be as deadly as Ebola or deadly as HIV. So that's the kind of risk that has gone largely undiscussed until recent years. Some European researchers have called for a moratorium on xenotransplantation until some of these issues can be discussed. Some people in this country have suggested that we have the kind of public discussion on this as a policy level so that if we want to go forward in xenotransplantation, that we should at least do so after we have made people aware of what the issues are.
You take what you call the rickety bridge position. What is that, and how did you make your decision? How did you reach your position?
Well, it seems to me that xenotransplants, first of all, have so much promise given the number of people who are in need of organ transplants. As you pointed out at the first of the hour, there are roughly 100,000 people who either get transplants or are on the waiting list of transplants or die while they wait. And this is a very large number of people. And truthfully, there are probably about another 100,000 who simply never get so far as to be evaluated. So if you think of there being roughly 200,000 people in need of organs, and only about 25,000 of those who actually get the organs, that's 175,000 people who will go without, and a large proportion of them are likely to die before they get an organ they need. What this means is we need some alternatives. And one of the alternatives that seemed most promising has been to make use of specially bred pigs in order to provide those organs. Now, there are a host of problems there, and I think, again, the story behind the news is that those problems are at a biological level are much more serious. The barriers between species are much more substantial than enthusiastic news stories tend to suggest. But if we could solve those problems, if we could get the organs, we could save literally hundreds of thousands of lives. So I think it's a goal worth pursuing. But on the other hand, is it a goal worth pursuing if it threatens to cause a worldwide pandemic of hemorrhagic fever? Well, no, it wouldn't if we thought that that was very likely. Now, we don't know exactly how likely it is, but I think that we at least have some notion on the basis of other experiences we've had with epidemic diseases that it's not likely to spread in the way that AIDS has spread if we are aware of what we're doing and take precautions. So my recommendation is, yes, we proceed with the research, but that we take considerable precautions in doing so, that we become aware of the possibilities, and that we be prepared to declare a moratorium on the research if things look dangerous.
Is this area of research currently regulated at all?
Xenotransplantation is regulated now by the FDA. It didn't used to be. But in order to go forward with an experiment using a human being, the FDA has to give its approval.
What about other places in the world?
In other places in the world, the regulation varies. In European research communities, it's as rigid, if not more so, than in the U.S. In other places in the world, there is fundamentally no regulation on research. So could some xenotransplanter and some offshore xenocenter make use of the technology that we have available and put us all at risk? The answer to that is yes.
The last chapter of the book is about the possibility, maybe one day, that we would be able to grow organs using our own cells. And this is really exciting, and researchers are just really beginning to work in this area. This is an area of research that involves stem cell engineering and tissue engineering. Can you give us some idea of the promise that this area holds, and then also, because we're running down here on time, where do you come down on the issue of embryonic stem cell research, and how did you reach your position?
This is a whole area that is tremendously exciting, the area of regenerative medicine. And the use of embryonic stem cells promises both to make, in many cases, the need for organ transplantation unnecessary, because if stem cells could be used, injected into organs that have been damaged or diseased, and it could restore the tissue, it could restore the functioning, it might well be that people could live with their own organs a full lifetime and never have a need for an organ transplant. On the other hand, that is something that is more immediate. If you look farther down the road, the ideal for organ transplantation would be to have replacement parts surgery, in which a perfectly tissue-matched organ, one that could be completely compatible with your tissues, might be implanted in you to replace your heart, your liver, your kidneys, whatever might be failing. And that would be one that, in this ideal scenario, and it has to be said, science fiction scenario, would be one that was grown by the use of embryonic stem cells, which does bring up, as you mentioned, the question about what is the status of the embryo. There are people who regard embryos, which are the source for these stem cells, as being the moral equivalent of a human being, of me or you, of a full-grown person, of anybody. That position means, then, that it would be wrong to kill an embryo in order to harvest the stem cells, in the same way that it would be wrong to shoot someone down on the street in order to take the organs and transplant them into someone else. And from this point of view, it would not be any more right to do that than it would be to destroy stem cells. Now, that point of view is widespread. It's a position that's endorsed by the Roman Catholic Church, not just by the Roman Catholic Church, by those who are socially and politically conservative as well. It's not a position that I find convincing. I think, by the way, that this is one of those topics in which we need to have an open discussion. The discussions typically about stem cells allude to kind of moral issues, but quite often those moral issues are not spelled out. But the fundamental issue behind the stem cell debate is the question of, what is your view of a human embryo? What is your view of one that is advanced to the stage of 5 to 15 days, in which it has developed about 500 cells, and some of those cells on the inside of that are the stem cells? Is destroying that embryo the same as destroying a human being? In my view, no, that it's not. While it's true that if the embryo were implanted in a uterus, the chances are good it would grow into being a human being, but at the earliest stages, I think that the fact that it has that potential does not itself mean that it has that actuality. This is a view, I think, that is probably widely shared in our society. So I am myself reluctant to allow, without debate, our society to move in the direction of, in effect, prohibiting or severely restricting stem cell research without our having a discussion of the status of the embryo.
Well, thank you so much for discussing some of these issues with us this afternoon.
It's been a great pleasure.
Ronald Munson has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a medical ethicist. He's professor of philosophy of science and medicine at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He is the author of Raising the Dead, Organ Transplants, Ethics, and Society. The book is published by Oxford.